We'll move on to the next case of this morning, Bernison against Motorola. Mr. Bellis.
Good morning, Judge. May it please the court, counsel. My name is George Bellis. I am appearing in this matter, and I have the privilege of appearing in this matter on behalf of the plaintiffs in this matter. Several years ago, this court wrote in an opinion in the Stone case, one does not have to be an employment expert to know that an employer can make an employee's job undesirable or even unbearable without money or benefits ever entering into the picture. This prescient comment by Judge Wood eventually resulted in this court's decision in Washington and later the United States Supreme Court decision in the Burlington Northern case. Those cases clarified the landscape and adopted a broad standard for retaliation in the workplace. The court held that unlawful retaliation conduct is not limited to employment or workplace-related actions. And in doing so, the Supreme Court followed the path blazed by this court in Washington.
Before you get too much further, Mr. Bellis, I would like you to clarify exactly what FMLA claims your clients are bringing. Maybe it's different for each one, but there's been some confusion about, you know, the substantive violation of whether, I don't think there's any question about the leave, but the reinstatement as being one possibility, a discrimination claim being a second possibility, and a retaliation claim. So if you could just kind of review who's doing what, that would help me.
Judge Wood, I'll be happy to do that, and I apologize if our brief wasn't clear on this. First of all, there is only one substantive claim that is being raised about the denial of benefits, and that has to do with James Bernison's return from his first leave in April of 2001. At that time, he was, prior to his going on leave, he was holding an administrative position that the human resource director indicated would qualify him for a salaried position. And there was either emails to that extent. When he returned from leave, he was put on an assembly line at the Rockford Service Center.
That's this keypad position?
Yes, ma'am.
And so, just to be absolutely clear, your assertion here is that there are disputed issues of fact as to whether the second position, the keypad position, was equivalent to the first one such that the FMLA substantive duties were satisfied?
That's correct.
Okay.
And there are disputed facts based primarily on the testimony of the person who replaced him, who stated in her deposition unequivocally that she is now holding the same position that James Bernison held before his leave.
Well, that's a little bit different in that, you see, I think you're blending two things here. What that might show is that he was not put back into his former position. But as I understand Motorola, it would have also satisfied its FMLA responsibilities if it had indeed put him in a substantially equivalent position. But I thought, wholly apart from whether the old job is still there, you're saying that the new job isn't substantially equivalent. It was inferior. It was perceived as a demotion, whatever.
That's correct. In fact, one of the defendants, operations manager, Mr. Shaw, confirmed that that was a lower position. So we have to. Although he was getting the same pay, it was not the equivalent position. He was given the context that this was done in, it is clear that it was an intention to put him and punish him for his actions. That is only the only substantive FMLA claim that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. The others all deal with retaliation. Mm-hmm. And deal with people who have exercised their rights and then came back to work and found themselves subject to the traumas that this court described in the Washington opinion would be the actions of a Catbert human resource director.
Well, then, since we're talking about the retaliation, and this would be Barbara Berenstein Jacobson, Laura Jones, and Anna Lineweaver. If we determine that the emails are not authentic, what evidence do we have to show that the retaliatory intent motivated the actions taken against them?
We're still left with the testimony of the individuals who indicated what was going on. We also have declarations from other employees that indicate that confirm that there were actions going on that were harassing of nature. We also have, before all this started, an email from the human resource director that indicated that that warned people that it is perceived within this environment that people who do exercise rights under the FMLA are treated differently after they return to work. So the context that this is placed in has to be important, and that goes to the veracity and the authenticity of the emails, because the emails by themselves might be questioned, but if we put them into the context of the entire situation, it's clear that the emails do affirm what others have witnessed or suspected, and that was there was a deliberate attempt on the part of individuals, including management, to let it be known that people who exercised rights under the FMLA were going to be treated differently and set aside so that the signal would be given to others that they were not to exercise FMLA rights.
But, you know, it seems to me, at a minimum, there is an issue about the authenticity of these emails. The magistrate judge seems, as I read the transcript, to have punted it over to the district court judge, and then the district court judge decides, in light of the decision that there were no adverse effects in the workplace, that it's not necessary to confront it. So I guess you have to explain to us why, for purposes of either Mr. Bernison's substantive claim or everybody's retaliation claim, this issue needs to be resolved once and for all by the district court or perhaps even by this court.
Well, retaliation by its very nature has an intent involved to it, and these emails go to intent. And why would
they? Do you think you need a hearing? I mean, to be honest, I don't think this court is in a position to resolve whether these were authentic emails or not. You know, reading all this,
we could agree on that.
Evidence about fragments and things that people can do with computers seems to me to cry out for some fact finding.
Which is what we asked for and suggested at the district court level in our responses to the motion for summary judgment as well. And that was also why we went into court and asked the magistrate as a sanction to authenticate the email so we wouldn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. But they are relevant, and their authenticity aside, there is no evidence that they're actually phony, by the way. Even their experts admit that if they may be forgeries, the forgeries were not conducted by the plaintiff, James Bernison, or any of the other plaintiffs.
Well, there is what you might call a colossal chain of custody problem, since the original electronic version doesn't seem to be available, and show up in some envelopes.
Right. Through no fault, there's no question that James Bernison himself was at fault in not understanding what the chain of evidence really meant and how he had to perfect it. But by the same token, we tried to authenticate it and ran into brick walls put up by Motorola. Motorola, this technological giant in the world, did not understand what two preservation orders by two different courts indicated, and that was to preserve the record, the electronic evidence in this matter. In fact, when the hard drives were eventually mirrored by the parties, it was found that there were fragments of emails on those hard drives of the individuals' computers that had been written after the last preservation order and deleted, so that the computers were in continuous use. So Motorola did nothing about preserving the evidence in this matter. And that was a fact that we thought we briefed and made extensively clear to the district court. But he pointed it, as you indicated, to the district court judge, who didn't even want to think about it, didn't even get to it, finding that intent was not important. And I would respectfully submit to this court that intent certainly was relevant.
Now, for your retaliation claim, there are a couple of different ways one might approach a retaliation claim. So were you attempting to prove through the use of these emails with direct evidence that there was retaliation?
Absolutely. Yeah. As well as, again, going to the intent of the parties. But it also was germane to the issue of the intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Now, that one, of course, if the federal claims go, there's an issue that no one briefed about whether it's appropriate to keep that claim anyway under supplemental jurisdiction. But even without that complication, if one looks at the Illinois cases on intentional infliction of emotional distress, and then you look at what happened in this workplace, it really seems to me this falls far short of anything the Illinois courts have recognized as stating that kind of claim.
Well, I respectfully would disagree with the court. The elements of intentional infliction of emotional distress, we submit and have briefed here. Well, I don't think we did it in our brief here, but we certainly responded at the district court level that all of the elements were satisfied. And we would submit that whether or not there is, in fact, a cause of action there, well, I'm sorry.
Well, the district judge went off on this preemption ground, whether it's preempted or not preempted, and everybody's briefed that. But beyond preemption, one of the alternative arguments that your opponents make is this doesn't constitute the tort anyway, and that's where I was looking at it.
Well, I thought I firmly believe that we have sufficient facts to set forth that cause of action, and it is not there are sufficient questions of fact as to whether or not it is that outrageous.
Well, but do any of the plaintiffs, because I have the same concern that Judge Wood has, there's no evidence in this record that the plaintiffs sought any kind of mental health treatment or counseling or saw a professional, right?
Not in the record that was briefed. However, we did have there was extensive discovery provided and conducted regarding the treatment that Mr. Bernaysen went through, both prior to, during, and subsequent to the retaliation in his FMLA leave.
But the only evidence, he's the only one where that kind of evidence was presented, correct? Not
was
on
the
any
only
of the
one
other
who,
plaintiffs who were claiming intentional infliction of emotional distress.
I don't believe any of the other plaintiffs.
So that's a big problem for you, isn't it? Because we don't even have to reach the preemption issue if you can't get over the hurdle of presenting enough evidence.
The district court didn't rule as to the sufficiency of those allegations, and that would be left for either this court, if it wants to review it de novo, to review all of the facts. If this court wanted to get into all the facts and consider whether or not we had a sufficient facts to respond to create a cause of action, you certainly can do that. But I would respectfully submit that should go to the district court. And notwithstanding the FML claims, if you don't even want to get to the preemption, if the FML claims are dismissed, we thought about it in raising it in our brief, but we thought we would leave it for this court to decide what would happen, and that is that the intentional infliction of emotional distress claims would then be remanded back to the federal court and have to be removed to the remanded back to the state court, because there would be no pendant jurisdiction for the federal court to consider that claim. So it would end up then in the state court.
You're well into your rebuttal time, by the way.
Yeah, if you want to save a little bit.
I was trying to respond to the questions, and I'm sorry.
I know you were doing a fine job. I just wanted to call your attention to it.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Ms. Gale.
May it please the Court, my name is Joan Gale, and I represent the defendants along with my co-counsel, Scott Carlson. Also seated with me at counsel table is Ms. Margaret Hockenberry from the Motorola Legal Department. Good morning, counsel. Your Honors, I'd like to just jump to one of the issues that you raised with Mr. Bellis before I go through the additional points I have here. Mr. Carlson will be addressing the authenticity and email issue. So if you have questions on that point, Mr. Carlson will be addressing them. In the brief to this court, counsel for the plaintiff raised the issue on the intentional infliction claim as only whether the district court made an error in ruling that the Family and Medical Leave Act preempted the tort claim. They did not put anything in their principal brief on the issue of the elements of the tort. They came back in the reply and did that. But our position is they've now waived that. And there was an additional argument that we made as well, which is that the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act would preempt the claim, certainly as against the corporate defendant. Again, that issue was not brought up in the brief.
Right. It seems to me, though, I mean, that they responded to the ground on which the district court had ruled. Lots of other things had been raised, but a plaintiff doesn't have the responsibility to go back to square one and rebrief everything that perhaps they won on. They don't know what the district court thought about these alternative grounds. You then, appropriately enough, you had briefed it before, raised them in your responsive brief, and so I think they can come back in their reply brief and say something about it.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think as to the point of extreme and outrageous conduct or intentional infliction and severe emotional distress, the record is barren of that evidence. And counsel made reference to, well, there was a lot of discovery about it, but that's really not the point. The record presented to this court has to present those facts for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the point that had me concerned about this particular claim, because if at this stage of the game, which is, far enough along, there'd been huge amounts of discovery, so we've got summary judgment, we have de novo review. If we look at what happened and say, you know, here's what Illinois requires, this isn't the extreme and outrageous, then that's a ground that would be an alternative ground on which you might be entitled to prevail. It depends on, you know, how one assesses these allegations against Illinois law.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to make a few points procedurally. Our position in our brief, and I think it's important to highlight, is that the plaintiffs didn't really comply with Rule 56 below. We submitted an extensive Rule 56 statement divided into each of the six plaintiffs, and then we had a general statement. And to our surprise, when they came back with their response to our Rule 56 statement, they only purported to contest five paragraphs, but they did not cite to the record. They denied it, but they did not cite to the record. And they filed a very extensive Rule 56 statement, which in some parts duplicated our statement, making it more difficult. And then they filed approximately 70 tabbed exhibits. It was a pile of about 8 inches thick. And it made it very, very difficult. Our position is very simple. If they did not cite to the record with evidentiary support in their denial, then the facts are deemed admitted.
But the district court chose to accept, I mean, this is something we usually leave up to the district courts. If the district courts want to work to rule on the Rule 56, the local Rule 56 procedure, which in the Northern District is 56.1, as you know, then we allow the district courts to do that. But if a district court says, well, I'm satisfied, you've put in substance in front of me what I need, we don't usually reach back and say a district court abused its discretion in refusing to insist on this strict compliance.
Well, I think it's significant because in our Rule 56 statement, we indicated that Mr. Brunison's position was eliminated and never reinstated, and they did not contest that fact properly. That is our position before this court.
And I think in the end, what we really are looking at here is the question whether there are disputed issues of material fact on the question whether the position to which he was returned, this keypad position, whether it was 8 days, whether it was 8 years, I don't think makes any difference. Was that, as the statute regards this, a substantially equivalent position? And my concern, frankly, from your point of view, is that it looks to me like there are some disputed facts on that, that one could see this as administrative versus kind of a line position. One could see it as different types of responsibilities. The law requires a very close correspondence between the two things. So whether or not he went back to his same job, it was eliminated, or whatever, I think is not as crucial as whether the job to which he was returned was substantially equivalent.
Your Honor, let me address that point. I believe the district court correctly concluded that the position was substantially equivalent and we therefore met our restoration obligation. As you pointed out, the statute says either the same position or an equivalent position, and we would submit that we reinstated Mr. Bernice into an equivalent position. And it's important to note that these positions, the position he held before and the position to which he was reinstated, paid the same, had the same benefits, the same hours, the same working conditions, the same shifts, and the same promotional opportunities. And I think
But not the same duties and responsibilities, not the same skill set, I'm not sure that the record is undisputed about promotion opportunities. I think, depending who you believe, there's evidence in the record that that's different. The statute just, it would have been very easy for Congress to have written a statute that said as long as you return somebody to a position with the same pay, you've satisfied your obligation. That would have been a nice, easy thing for all of us to administer. Maybe we would have loved that, but it's not the statute we got. And there's evidence that other people saw it as a demotion. The senior operations manager, Mr. Shaw, other people. So I don't know. I mean, you're right that there's a lot that's similar. Maybe a jury would believe that, but I think that one could look at this glass as half empty.
Your Honor, I just have to respectfully disagree, but I want to make the point about what counsel has in his reply brief that Mr. Shaw said. That's not in the Rule 56 statement at all. And what I would like to just point out to this court, within their primary brief and the reply brief, they cite only to that mass of exhibits. They do not cite the Rule 56 statement. And I could not find, I actually electronically searched through their Rule 56 statement, because we incorporated it when we answered it, to find that piece that was in the reply brief about what Mr. Shaw supposedly said. It's not in there. And I think that's significant. The court, neither
and
this court...
And just so we're clear, that's the statement where the plant operations manager acknowledged that the new position had less prestige,
correct,
less visibility. That's the statement,
correct,
you're saying.
That is
not
in the Rule 56 statement. I could not find it.
It's in his deposition. Well, I mean...
It's in the deposition.
Yeah. Deposition.
But
yeah,
to
right.
have to file with a summary judgment motion 70 separate exhibits, including full deposition transcripts, and then say later, well, you know, this little piece was in here, is inappropriate. That piece is not part of their Rule 56 submission. I would also point to the court that I think one of the hallmarks of equivalence is promotional opportunities, and in fact, the record is very clear. Mr. Bernison came back for a period of 8 days in April of 2001 after taking 12 weeks of FMLA, and it was his 14th FMLA leave. He then went out again and returned in September. He had no restoration rights at that point. However, he was reinstated, put back for a very brief period of time on the keypad job, and then he was promoted to another administrative position with a 4% increase. And I think that's very significant here.
I don't know. I mean, again, I can imagine you arguing that, but there is a lot of evidence in the record that the position, the interim position, which, as you point out, didn't last very long, and maybe that would go to amount of damages. I mean, maybe you would say, well, he didn't get reinstated to exactly the same position, but the consequences were practically trivial.
Damages, Your Honor. And the FMLA does not provide for compensatory damages for pain and suffering or punitive damages, so there are no damages under the FMLA, even if you're correct that this possibly raises an issue of fact. I want to reserve time for my counsel here, and I just want to briefly address a couple other issues. With regard to
into his time, I'm not sure. Not yet? Okay.
Thank you. With regard to the retaliation issue below, when we briefed this, the only issue that counsel for plaintiff came back with was interference with rights. There was nothing about retaliation. We obviously argued the issue of materiality, and we believe the district court got it correct, that the Burlington Northern or the Washington case doesn't require any kind of reversal in this case. It's just semantics. And finally, with regard to FMLA preemption, I just wanted to note that where the facts underlying the tort claim are the same, and they are in this case, they're one and the same with the FMLA claims, it was the correct decision. If there aren't any other questions for me, I'd like to turn it over to my co-counsel.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson.
May it please the court, counsel. The fundamental issue, and I will address the email authenticity issue. Fundamentally, we've gone back and forth through the history of this case with calling them emails, calling them purported emails, calling them phony emails. We have to come back to what they were. They were five pieces of paper of dubious origin.
But I guess my question for you, Mr. Carlson, is unless you could somehow convince us that there was really no need to reach this issue, which is the way the district court handled it, it's hard for me to see how this is not a factual question that needs to be resolved at the district court level, because they may be five pieces of paper, but they look like emails, and maybe they say things that you think no rational manager would say, but I can think of all too many instances in which people say that people get very unbuttoned in emails, actually. There have been amusing articles in the newspaper about that, and I think this looks like an evidentiary issue to me.
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's basically we have the plaintiffs had the burden of putting forward admissible facts to try to create a genuine issue of material fact. They tried in two ways. They tried first through a sanction, and then they tried secondarily through a 901 determination, that it met the burden of Rule 901. Under the sanction arena, they just failed.
The magistrate judge said, I'm not ready to do that. Let the district judge resolve it. And then it goes over to Judge Reinhart, and he says, I don't have to. So we don't ever get closure on this.
Well, we look, though, when the first motion before the magistrate judge was a Rule 37 discovery motion sanction, asking that the emails be deemed admissible. That was not appealed. The magistrate said, yeah, there may be some issues down the road. There may be something the trial judge wants to do at trial, and I'm not foreclosing that, but I'm telling you, as Rule 37 goes and as your motion is framed and the evidence has been heard, it is denied. And that motion was not appealed to the district court. So then we move to the next time the sanction issue is raised, or this effort to create a sanction to find them admissible. And it's vague. In the reply to the summary judgment, plaintiffs say they go through some of these same arguments that we heard in the magistrate, but the relief they ask for is that they simply say, well, this should weigh heavily on the court's mind. There's no request.
Specific. I mean, attached to plaintiff's brief is a bit of a transcript before Magistrate Judge Mahoney from a June 9, 2003 hearing in which he says, I'm not at the point that the orders are specific enough that I'm willing to authenticate the documents under Rule 37. I think counsel, and this will be up to the trial judge, not me. And he says, I'm not saying you don't have some type of spinoff of spoliage argument to make to Judge Reinhart. It reads to me, taken as a whole, as I'm tossing this over to Judge Reinhart. I don't think he's really making a ruling that on the merits, this doesn't warrant Rule 37 sanctions or any other type.
He does specifically say, though, I am not at the point to deem these admissible.
Right, I am not at the point. That's the
but
point
he
exactly.
Ends up, Your Honor, though.
That's not a rejection.
Well, then when is the issue next raised? Even if that assumed that the Rule 37 is somehow still not ruled upon, which it was denied. So we'll assume that it was not ruled upon.
Well, you've got to assume that if it was denied.
I'm sorry,
I just think you have to assume that if it was denied.
I think it was denied.
Didn't he say it was denied?
Yeah.
He denies the motions. But
right.
The court is suggesting that the Rule 37 is still out there, and I'm trying to follow
no,
up on
no,
that.
No, the Rule 37 is not out there. It's just denied at this time. That's how I interpret what she said.
For the time being.
This time, it's denied.
So the next... He's not saying you can never raise it again. He wants more to happen, and he wants it to happen at the district court.
And so the next time the plaintiffs seek to raise this question, to try to get a sanction to deem these admissible, the next time we hear from them is in a reply to the summary judgment, where they don't, frankly, ask the trial judge, please rule, please sanction them and deem this admissible. They say simply, they go through some of the same arguments and then say, this should bear heavily on the court's mind in deciding the summary judgment. No relief asked for, no deeming of admissibility asked for. That's it. It's just this sort of this vague notion of here's these arguments, dirty up the defendants, and we don't quite know what the court should do with it. There's no specific relief asked for at all.
But then when you finally get to Judge Reinhart's statement, he finally, in the penultimate paragraph, he says, the court need not address the admissibility of the disputed emails or the expert testimony related to them. Doesn't he have to address it?
I don't think he does. He has, because we've got Rule 901 here. I think this court, in a de novo review, can look at it. You're not going to issue a sanction.
Yeah, but why do sanctions even have to play in the game? This was a summary judgment motion. That's what I'm getting hung up on. I mean, somehow you think that there has to be a carryover the sanction motion in order to really have this before the court. This was presented in the summary judgment, the emails. The judge specifically said, I don't have to reach this. I'm not ruling on this. I don't need to get to this.
What I'm suggesting
The vehicle doesn't have to be the sanctions motion, which seems to be what you're saying, that needed to happen again in order for it to be considered.
I see my time is up if I can answer your question, Your Honor. There's twofold. One is the sanction aspect, which I don't think they made it. I don't think it is ripe here. I think it was waived. The other is the 901 circumstances, where we've laid out that they don't meet the prima facie case, that this is nowhere near the circumstances that can provide these five emails under Rule 901 to make them even potentially create a genuine issue of material fact. That was the plaintiff's burden. We've laid it out in our briefs. And they have not met that prima facie case.
Right, and the judge did not say that.
The judge did not say it, and I think this court is presented with the same.
The judge did not say, and you didn't meet your burden on the emails, and they're inadmissible. And that's the problem.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor. We would ask that the court affirm the decision of the trial judge. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Bellis?
I would like to clarify something, if I might, that Mr. Carlson said. In what we attempted to do to get to the bottom of these emails, Mr. Bernaysen was terminated, or he left, I'm sorry, in beginning of February 2001. This lawsuit was filed in the beginning of April 2001 in the Circuit Court of Lake County. It was then removed by the defendants to the U.S. District Court in Chicago here. Judge Holderman then sua sponte transferred it to the Western District in Rockford. Immediately after this action was filed in April of 2001, plaintiffs asked for and got from the Circuit Court of Lake County a preservation order. Before this matter was transferred to the Western District, plaintiffs also got a preservation order. So plaintiffs were affirmatively trying to preserve the electronic evidence. The first attempt to get to it and authenticate it was not through motion of sanction. It was through preservation orders. I'm sorry.
No, okay. Well, you can go ahead and finish up on that. I have another question.
Yeah, please.
On a different side. Are you done?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay, on this Rule 56, you rely heavily on this Alan Shaw about the difference in the position and why it was not equivalent, even though the pay was the same, and that's not included in your 56 statement, right? It's just in the deposition.
I believe that is correct.
Yeah, why wasn't it included, and why should we consider it?
The fact that we may have omitted to do that and neglected to do that, but we raised it later on because we did not really think that they were going to make the issue that they did out of it as to the substantial position. And more importantly, we already had other evidence, direct evidence from the person who took his Mr. Bernaysen's place, that she had taken his position. It was not replaced. She had his position. In fact, she said that flat out in her deposition. So we already had evidence to show that there was a disputed fact. This would have been on top of everything else, and we raised it, I believe, to show the disingenuousness of their position to now argue that it was not that it was not a substantially similar position. And I'm sorry I didn't even get to preemption. That was I was hoping to get to that. Thank you, Your Honor. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel, I should say. The case will be taken under advisement.